Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 230. In For the Record program number 227, we took a look at a Los Angeles police scandal involving the alleged planting of evidence and framing of numerous suspects. These deeds were allegedly performed by members of the LAPD's anti-gang units known as CRASH, all in capital letters. We also ruminated about some of the implications of these scandals for the O.J. Simpson case. And what we're going to look at in this broadcast are the implications of these scandals for law enforcement in California and law enforcement in general. We're going to be referencing an article from the Los Angeles Times of December 31st of 1999. This is an article that is by Ted Rohrlich, R-O-H-R-L-I-C-H. Its headline, Scandal Shows Why Innocent Plead Guilty, subtitled The L.A. Police Probe Casts Light on Cases in Which Suspects Admit Guilt for Crimes They Didn't Commit, Rather Than Risk Much Longer Prison Terms If Convicted at Trial. The article reads in part as follows, and again, this is from the L.A. Times of December 31st of 1999. The article begins on page 1. Joseph Jones had quite a choice. He could plead guilty to selling drugs he had not sold and serve 8 years in prison, or he could risk being convicted at trial and, as a three-time loser, be sentenced to life. Ex-felon Miguel Hernandez was offered a similarly absurd break, unquote. He could give up 16 months of his life by pleading guilty to possessing a weapon he never had, or he could demand a trial and face the possibility of 4 or more years in prison. In offering criminal defendants these kinds of Hobson's choices, prosecutors and judges did not set out to induce innocent men to plead guilty, although that is what they did. The prosecutors and judges merely accepted the word of Los Angeles police that the men were guilty. That the police turned out to be lying, and that victims of the Rampart police scandal wound up pleading guilty to crimes they did not commit, shows the extent to which police hold people's whole worlds in their hands. The still-unfolding scandal scorecard, convictions have so far been overturned against 10 defendants who pleaded guilty and against another who was found guilty at trial. More reversals are expected. The main job of the criminal courts, separating the innocent from the guilty, is difficult under the best of circumstances. When the police lie, it becomes all but impossible. Prosecutors are almost wholly dependent on police for the information they use to bring cases. And because of a popular anti-crime crackdown in California that has lasted more than 15 years, prosecutors more than ever run the state's criminal courts. Criminal defense lawyers these days are rarely in a position even to test in court the strength of information the police have gathered and prosecutors present. Anti-crime ballot initiatives have gutted the key vehicle for such tests, preliminary hearings. Eyewitnesses for the prosecution no longer have to testify at these hearings, held to determine whether there is sufficient evidence to order an accused to stand trial. So their recollections cannot be probed by defense counsel. Instead, police officers have been empowered to stand in for them and give their accounts secondhand. While this restriction and others hamper the defense's ability to gauge its chances of prevailing at trial, increasingly harsh punishments created by other anti-crime initiatives raise the stakes of going to trial. Prosecutors hold these harsh punishments over the heads of defendants as negotiating tools to get them to plead guilty at an early stage of proceedings, often before any meaningful defense investigation has taken place. The Rampart cases stand as a reminder that this kind of efficiency has its price. In the Rampart cases, prosecutors and judges, most of whom are former prosecutors, did what they routinely do. They offered discounts on punishment to those who agreed to plead guilty without putting the courts to the time and expense of conducting trials. The defendants did what defendants typically do. They took their deals. They evidently believed they would be convicted anyway if they stood trial. No one would take their word against that of the police, and courts would then punish them more harshly, saying they deserved it in part because they had not shown remorse. The big question is, do the police regularly lie? In the Rampart cases, it is now alleged they told whoppers. Some police administrators and legal commentators believe that police often tell relatively small lies, mostly to justify unlawful searches that turn up illegal weapons or drugs. These kinds of lies typically involve claims that officers saw a defendant drop drugs on the ground when an officer actually turned them up in a search of the defendant, or, more egregiously, claims that an officer saw a defendant drop drugs that the officer cannot actually link to the defendant because he merely saw the drugs lying near the defendant and infer that they belong to him. Joseph McNamara, former chief of police in Kansas City, Missouri, and San Jose, has said he believes hundreds of thousands of police officers tell those kinds of lies in court every year to convict people they are convinced are guilty who would otherwise go free. Conservative U.S. Ninth Circuit Circuit Court of Appeals Judge Alex Kozinski, K-O-Z-I-N-S-K-I, has called this kind of police perjury widespread and described it as, quote, an open secret long shared by prosecutors, defense lawyers, and judges. Not everyone agrees. Los Angeles County District Attorney Gil Garcetti said, quote, I've been a prosecutor for 31 years. I've handled thousands of cases, and yes, on occasion we've had cause to question the veracity of a police officer, but there have been so few of those cases. When they arise, he said, they are not tolerated. A prosecutor who suspects an officer is lying, Garcetti said, is encouraged to relay his suspicion to the officer's department. But Garcetti could cite only one case that led to a prosecution for police perjury. Los Angeles Superior Court Judge James Albrocht, a former deputy district attorney, thinks he knows why. There is tremendous pressure on prosecutors and judges to ignore police lying, he said. A young prosecutor who challenges a veteran cop's claim is dead meat, said Albrocht, again quoting, they'll complain to your supervisor. You've got some kind of Jerry Brown liberal here, unquote. Judges are in a pickle too, said Albrocht, who was appointed by Brown. The district attorney's office, which prosecutes all felony cases in the county, can, and does on rare occasions, boycott a judge it does not like by filing peremptory challenges against him in every case. Quote, if you called the police liars, they'd paper you, unquote, the judge said, and then, quote, instead of working on a nice assignment near your home, they, your fellow judges, send you downtown or to juvenile or dependency court where they send the slugs, unquote. Few in the legal system believe that police routinely engage in the kind of extreme lies alleged in the Rampart scandal. These were not lies to justify how evidence was found or linked to a defendant. They were lies about whether evidence was found at all. Former Los Angeles police officer turned informant Rafael Perez, the scandal's central figure, says he and his colleagues planted illegal guns and drugs on suspects, and in at least one case deliberately shot a gang member, then framed him for trying to kill them. The alleged audacity of Perez and his colleagues came to light not because of checks and balances in the criminal justice system, that is, not because some judges, prosecutors, defense lawyers, or police colleagues had moments of spectacular insights, courage, or contrition, but only because Perez was himself caught stealing cocaine from a police locker and confessed to win himself a deal. The sheer power of his lies, which would presumably have gone undetected if he had not admitted them, can be seen in the case of Samuel Bailey, whom Perez now says he framed for the crime of being an ex-felon with a gun. Bailey was a gang member in his early 30s who had been in trouble most of his adult life. He encountered Perez outside a gang party that Perez and other Rampart anti-gang officers were raiding. Perez claimed on the witness stand at Bailey's preliminary hearing that he saw Bailey when he pulled up to the party and recognized him as a gang member on parole. He said that he noticed Bailey had his right hand in his waistband. He said he told Bailey to put his hands up. Bailey, he said, instead pulled a handgun from his wallet and dropped it. Bailey just listened at the defense table as Perez perjured himself about the gun. Then the judge asked Perez how he had known that Bailey was a gang member. Quote, I have interviewed him 15-20 times, began Perez, again quoting, I have interviewed him 15 or 20 times, said Perez. It was too much for Bailey. He erupted in profanity and called Perez a liar. You're a lying expletive deleted, you know that. Sorry, Your Honor. The judge quickly reminded him where he stood. Let me explain something, he said. You have a right to speak only to your lawyer, and very quietly, and if you do that again, there will be a gag in your mouth, unquote. Bailey seemed to get it. He pleaded guilty soon afterward to possessing the gun that Perez now says he planted on him, in return for a sentence of 2 years and 8 months in prison. It was more or less the same story with Joseph Jones and Miguel Hernandez. Hernandez had been standing in the mouth of an alley when Perez and his partner, Officer Nino Durden, drove by. Perez's partner claimed he locked eyes with him, and Hernandez responded by pulling a gun from his waist and dropping it. Perez now says Hernandez did not have a gun. It was a plant. But Hernandez, who had a long record, took a deal at his very first Superior Court appearance, pleading guilty in return for a 16-month term. Jones was accused by Perez and Durden of being the middleman in their undercover purchase of $20 worth of rock cocaine in the hallway of a residential hotel. Perez now says that Jones actually refused to sell them the cocaine. Framed, Jones was in a tough spot. Because he had been convicted of roughing up and robbing two pedestrians at knife point in 1992, the district attorney's office could have prosecuted him for a third strike. Conviction would have resulted in a life term. When prosecutors offered instead to let him plead guilty to a second strike, he took the deal. "All right, this is number 27," said Superior Court Judge John Reed, a former prosecutor referring to Jones's place on the calendar. "You're Joseph Jones?" "Yes, sir." Number 27 went along with the program and accepted an 8-year sentence for a crime. Number 27 went along with the program and accepted an 8-year sentence for a crime Perez now says he did not commit. The next section of the article deals with a provision in L.A. court called a People versus West plea, and this is straight out of 1984 for people who have read that novel by George Orwell. Criminal justice is administered so inexactly that courts regularly allow people to plead guilty while claiming they are innocent. It keeps the system moving. It is deemed kosher as long as the defendants say that they believe it is in their interest to plead guilty, that their lawyers concur, and that a judge believes there is strong evidence that they are in fact guilty. The, quote, strong evidence, unquote, can be as little as a second-hand account of a police report. In Los Angeles courts, the common way of signaling that such a hybrid plea is taking place is to cite an old California Supreme Court decision known as People versus West, which said it was permissible in the interest of justice for a drug defendant to plead guilty to another charge that didn't quite fit his crime to avoid a mandatory state prison sentence. This last sentence again, because it's a doozy. In Los Angeles courts, the common way of signaling that such a hybrid plea is taking place is to cite an old California Supreme Court decision known as People versus West, which said it was permissible in the interests of justice for a drug defendant to plead guilty to another charge that didn't quite fit his crime to avoid a mandatory state prison sentence. Counsel, is this a People versus West plea, or is this a plea because the defendant in truth and in fact is guilty? A deputy district attorney asked a defense lawyer in one of the Rampart cases. Oscar Peralta, now believed by the district attorney's office to have been another victim of the police scandal, took the People versus West route, pleading to charges that he assaulted police with a gun. His case, which featured aggressive defense representation, illustrates the willingness of some judges and prosecutors to vest police with extra credibility, despite independent evidence suggesting they may be lying. Peralta was an 18th Street gang member. He was shot by one of Perez's colleagues in the anti-gang unit in the Rampart Division, home of some of the city's most intense gang wars. Then he was charged with an assault on police that purportedly led to his being shot. Perez has since said that the shooting was, quote, dirty, unquote, and prosecutors have said they believe Peralta was the victim of a police crime. Skipping down, more about the Peralta case, the Brown here is the public defender Bruce Brown, who was Peralta's defense attorney. Brown was disgusted, quote, "You have a bench appointed by a series of Republican governors. That's the systemic issue," unquote, he said, again quoting, "They are unwilling in large part to dispense with criminal proceedings that ought to terminate at an early stage. They are one step short of rubber stamps," unquote. Thanks to judicial appointments by a series of conservative Republican governors, California judges more often than not are former prosecutors. Gene Guccione, a reporter for the legal newspaper, the Los Angeles Daily Journal, has found that 56% of Governor Pete Wilson's appointees and 65% of Governor George Dukmejian served as prosecutors. Governor Dukmejian alone appointed more than 1,000 judges, or 55% of the state's bench, including Kennedy Powell. Only 7% of Wilson and Dukmejian appointees had experience as public defenders. The rest were civil lawyers. Brown did not think that prosecutors would ever agree to dismiss the case against Peralta because a dismissal would offend police and might harm police chances to prevail in any civil litigation that arose from the shootings. So he urged his client to take a deal if a good one was offered. Quote, "When I talk to a client who is denying guilt about accepting a plea, I talk as if they're in the process of buying insurance, a form of protection," unquote, Brown said. Again quoting, "You don't want to wind up getting convicted at trial when you're truly innocent and getting a ridiculously long sentence," unquote. Months went by. Finally, prosecutors offered Peralta a deal too good to refuse. They promised they would let him go if he would just say he did it. Peralta pleaded no contest to assault and guilty via People versus West to having been armed. He was placed on probation, and he had to spend 305 days in jail. Before accepting the deal, Superior Court Judge Robert O'Neill, a Wilson appointee and former prosecutor, wanted to make sure of one thing, that it was okay with the police. Quote, "I understand the basis for this disposition is the fact that there are factual difficulties," the judge said. "Indeed, this disposition has been run past the agency that employed the individuals in this matter. Is that correct?" Unquote. Assured that the answer was yes, he let it go through. And the next section of the article refers to a shooting, a Javier Francisco Ovando, who was accused of having tried to ambush some policemen on the part of gangs. He was accused of being a gang assassin. He had been shot in the head and had no recollection as a result, or no clear recollection of exactly what had taken place. And his attorney, a Tom R. Toister, T-O-I-S-T-E-R, also a public defender, was burdened at the time with 27 other felony clients and didn't have a lot of time to do research. So that's the context here of the shooting of Javier Francisco Ovando and his alleged attempt to ambush police, which was the cause for his shooting. The Toister here again is Deputy Public Defender Tamar Toister. Although Toister had doubts about some aspects of the police account, she said she never imagined the truth as Perez now tells it. She could not imagine that, as Perez now says happened, police would have repeatedly shot an unarmed man and planted a machine gun on him to make him look like a would-be assassin. At the time of trial, Toister believed that her client had probably blundered armed into what he believed had been an empty apartment, and to his surprise, encountered police who became frightened and shot him. But she also thought that the police had probably made some kind of a mistake in the shooting and were trying to cover it up. She did not know what kind of mistake. But her suspicions were aroused when she noticed at trial that they seemed to be going out of their way to embellish their accounts to emphasize how difficult it would have been for Ivando to have just walked in. The officers had previously described the building to police investigators, assigned to look into the officer-involved shooting, as primarily vacant, unquote, during remodeling. Toister found that description consistent with Ivando's contention that a friend of his lived there and that he sometimes visited the friend. But at trial, the police portrayed the building as empty. They said they had to vault a 10-foot fence to get in. Without much of a defense, Toister tried to exploit these new claims as contradictions. But Judge Stephen Zulliger, C-Z-U-L-E-G-E-R, a Duke Mason appointee and former federal prosecutor, ruled that she could not. Perhaps, he suggested, the officers had mentioned the new details to the investigators, but the investigators had not written them down. Toister protested that the judge's ruling was unfair. She had asked for the officer's tape-recorded statements as part of the pretrial discovery process. But another judge who had handled motions in the case had not ordered the police department to turn over the recordings. All Toister had was the investigator's summaries. Toister had not made a fuss about this until Zulliger prevented her from using them to impeach the officers. "Judge," she then said, "I'm at a loss. This is the only report I have." But she neither pushed the issue nor demanded a trial, figuring, she said, that it would be pointless because Zulliger would not bend. And skipping down in the article, Toister considered calling Ovando to the witness stand. She told the judge, quote, "Ovando's testimony would be that he has been to that building before. He has a friend who lived in the building, and that on the day in question he has no recollection because he was shot in the head, arm, chest, and back," unquote. but Ovando elected not to testify when the judge would not guarantee that he would preclude the prosecutor from telling the jury, if he did, that Ovando was a gang member. Zuliger had barred prosecutors from using the existence of anti-LAPD gang graffiti on the building and Ovando's gang membership to argue to the jury its theory of motive that this was a gang hit. He ruled that the prejudice of gang evidence to Ovando outweighed its probative value to the prosecution, but he said it might become relevant as rebuttal if Ovando testified that he had been in the building for an innocent purpose. Toyster's argument to the jury was that the police account was implausible. But the prosecutor, Deputy District Attorney Frank Lucas, L-U-K-U-S, argued that there was no reasonable alternative explanation. Quote, What would defense counsel have you believe, he asked, again quoting, that they found this guy on the street, dragged him up there, and shot him for some obscure reason of their own, unquote? When the jury came back with a guilty verdict, the prosecutor wrote a searing memorandum focused on the gang evidence and asking the judge to impose the maximum term. The prosecution had offered a 13-year deal in return for a guilty plea before trial. Going to trial cost Ovando 10 more, as Judge Zuliger imposed a 23-year term. Defense lawyer Toyster said she had learned the hard way that going to trial was not necessarily the best course for an innocent client. Quote, my first felony jury trial, she explained. Innocent guy gets convicted, gets the maximum sentence. My third felony jury trial, innocent guy gets convicted, gets the max. Now why would I tell anybody, don't plea bargain because you're innocent, unquote. But such a decision is the client's, and in this case, Toyster had agreed with Ovando's desire to take his chances. She said she thought he might do better than the deal, even if he were convicted. The reason was that he cut such a pathetic figure. Repeatedly shot by police, palsied, confined to a wheelchair, he was hard to imagine as a public safety threat. But in hammering him, Zuliger cited an aggravating factor, the defendant's attitude. Most apparently, he observed, the defendant has no remorse, unquote. And that apparently was the dominant factor here in this particular decision. So again, this article from the Los Angeles Times of December 31st of 1999 by Ted Rorlick. The article is entitled, Scandal Shows Why Innocent Plead Guilty, subtitled The L.A. Police Probe Casts Light on Cases in Which Suspects Admit Guilt for Crimes They Didn't Commit, rather than risk much longer prison terms if convicted at trial. And the article points out that because of anti-crime initiatives and because of the relationship between prosecutors and judges, most of whom are former prosecutors, and the police, it is now apparently fairly routine in criminal justice cases in California for innocent suspects to be advised to plead guilty to crimes they did not commit in order to avoid being convicted of more serious crimes because they could not be proved innocent. Not a good state of affairs at all. And note again the People versus West plea, which permits a client to plead guilty while claiming they are innocent, which is, again, straight out of 1984. The various tapes that I produced over the years are available from a tape duplication service called Spitfire. That is one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E. They're located at P.O. Box 1179. That's in Ben Lomond, California, capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. The email address for Spitfire is spitfire@ix.netcom.com. That's spitfire@ix.netcom.com. There's a list of and description of the various tapes available from Spitfire on the Spitfire website. That is at thespitfirelist.com, www.spitfirelist.com. That website is also equipped with real audio so that listeners can hear the various programs going out to the stations that carry it when they're going out. And you can also see a matching list and description on the KFJC website at kfjc.org. Look in the Transmissions and Public Affairs sections. I also have an email address, demory@kfjc.org. Once again, that's demory@kfjc.org. That concludes this broadcast. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.